Welcome to Gator Bites, the official business podcast of the Maryland Davies College of Business. I'm your host, Miguel Gomez, and with us today we have Timothy Coulter. Welcome.
Yeah, good to be here.
So tell us about yourself, Timothy.
Well, my career actually started in banking, like back in 2003. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life, and I got a job as a retail banker. And so I thought, okay, I kind of like this pretty well, so let me just keep doing it. And so I majored in finance, which took me like 6 years to get the degree. And so that probably should have been a giant red flag that it was not for me. But it helped me climb the ladder in the corporate world. The challenge was, is as I climbed the ladder, I became more and more empty from like a purpose on this planet perspective. And so I began to reflect on like, what am I doing here? Not in like a suicidal sort of way, but in like, what am I doing here? And I kept coming back to this idea of helping others. And so I looked at lots of different helping professions, and counseling actually wasn't my first choice. I was looking at optometry, but something about counseling kind of like kept sparkling at me in my peripheral vision. So I said, you know what, let me check out this counseling thing and see if it's for me. And the more I read about it and the more I talked to therapists, I was like, I really kind of like this. This is really cool. And so I was thankful that I was accepted to a master's program with a finance background. No psychology background at all, but I guess they saw something in me. And they allowed me in, and I did well, and then the rest is history.
Wow. So you are now a professional counselor here at UHD Counseling, correct?
Correct. I've been fortunate to be a therapist in lots of different environments. This is by far my favorite.
Oh, wow. That's very meaningful in terms of being able to make that shift from finance all the way to counseling. You know, you go from different ends of the spectrum, and you sort of let your heart lead you in that direction. Would that be a fair statement?
Partially fair. You know, you have to draw some intention to it. Yeah. You know, sometimes we just hope something's going to happen. Well, sometimes we got to make something happen.
That's
and
true.
That's through generating the question and then drawing intention. Now that I have the question, what am I going to do with it?
You know, intention is everything. But I want to ask you, can you give us an overview of the mental health services available here on campus?
Absolutely. So we serve all actively enrolled students. So what that means is if you drop out, if you graduate, then our services come to an end. But as long as you're actively enrolled, then you can come see us. The therapy is unlimited. It's free. Technically, you already pay for it through your tuition. So free in the sense that you don't have to pay anything else. And of course, it's completely private. So the system we use is completely separate from the system the school uses. As therapists, we're not allowed to talk about your personal information or your notes with, you know, your parents, your siblings, whoever else, your friends. In the hallways, sometimes we won't even say hello to you because that's to protect you. Now, of course, if you come up to us, we'll chat and talk and all of that. But confidentiality is like the key thing. Some students, I'd say maybe about 2% of the students I see come to me about academics. Hey, my time management isn't where I want it to be, or my study skills suck, or whatever. The other 98% come for other things. You know, there's some family challenges, some relationship challenges. They're angry, depressed, anxious, you know, taking drugs, whatever. And then we can engage in that type of therapy the vast majority of the time.
Wow, it seems like you focus both on building the individual, but also listening to the individual and helping them find that peace that they seek within themselves, whether it's through time management or through just even having a helpful ear to just listen to them and help them sort of address and navigate the challenges that they face in their day-to-day lives.
That's the hope. You know, what I'm learning about a lot of the students here is that they're dealing with a lot not related to school. And part of that is many people in their life try to tell them what to do, direct their life for them. You have to major in this degree, or you have to conduct yourself in a certain way, or don't do this or do this. And sometimes therapy is really just about creating a safe, non-judgmental space for the student to kind of explore what they want for themselves without someone exercising this external control. And that can be really powerful.
Yeah. I want to ask you, we've already passed the COVID era. And what are some of the challenges, you know, common mental health challenges that you've seen after the pandemic? You know, we withdrew, but then we had to find ways to reconnect again.
Well, the effects of the pandemic are still present with us. You know, there's a lot of people, especially if you graduated high school during the pandemic, you've looked at the same faces, just your family, for like 2 years. And that gets in the way of building relationships outside of the family. It's like almost you forget to socialize in a sense. Or how to socialize. And so right after COVID, we dealt with a lot of depression, suicidal ideation, loneliness, you know, social skills, that type of stuff. And there's still some of that present, like a little bit of a hangover, if you will. Now it's kind of changed. I see a lot of students come in with anxiety. Grief is a big one. Like our students have a lot of people dying. I don't know else to say that. And so grief is something I work with in a very common sort of basis.
I think that one's meaningful for me. And you know, I'd like to share something with the viewers as well. At the beginning of my MBA program, I was fortunate enough to have my dad see me get into the program. Mm. But he passed away a week into my MBA program. And counseling was there for me. And for that idea that a lot of us are going through grief, it's not linear. It's something that comes in waves. And for me, it's something that I had to realize at some point I needed to get help and I needed to talk to someone to navigate my grief to be able to sort of keep the other parts of my life together. And I think that that's something that a lot of our students face right, here
like
on campus.
Like almost like these waves of grief are knocking me out of balance or knocking me out of whack.
Yeah.
If I don't find some way to stabilize, then I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Yeah. And more often than not, students have to be able to find that balance, but also they still have the responsibility of having to go through school, go to work. And it's something that they need strategies to be able to cope and to be able to address grief. And, you know, I want to ask you, how do you know when to say, I need help? I think that that's something that is really challenging for a lot of people to say, I need help. Mm. And, you know, what would be the first step if someone wants to get help with counseling?
Well, that's a great point.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our students, their family members don't believe like mental health is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like just, you know, to tough it out and suck up your emotions and go about your day, grow up, deal with it like an adult. Or they say, we shouldn't talk to anyone about the problems except for elders in the family.
Yeah.
And so it creates these barriers to the student even feeling comfortable accessing our services because they have to go against what the family norms are. But to answer your question, how do you know? Like, I think one way to figure it out is if you normally take really good care of yourself and then all of a sudden you're not. Like, I always go to the gym an hour a week and all of a sudden I'm never going to the gym. I always eat healthy and then all of a sudden it's, you know, Snickers and Twix every day. Like, there's something going on that you're responding to by not doing the normal things that you know work. So that can be an indicator. Knowledge of self, I think, is critical there. Like if you know that, I don't know, you have a drink on the weekends and all of a sudden you're taking shots of vodka before every class, that's indicative that something is going on. And if you learn to pay attention to yourself, hopefully before it becomes too much of an issue, you can pay attention to that signal and say, oh, need help. That's one way. Listen to the people around you. Friends especially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, friends sometimes are a little bit less directive and more honest than family. And they hopefully have a good sense to be able to tell you, like, hey man, something's not right. I don't know what it is. You should talk to someone. If life feels like it's slipping through your hands like sand, that can be another indicator that I'm not gripping onto things the way I normally do. Like, I need to talk to someone about this. And then the other thing is if just something huge takes place in life, like you described with your own personal story.
Yeah. I think that going back to something that you said in terms of family and societal pressures, but mostly family in terms of like culture, at least from my perspective. I'm from a Mexican household, but from a young age, we're taught to sort of compartmentalize and to be strong and keep our feelings to ourselves. But one thing that I've learned through counseling, for example, is that the meaning of strong is different in many ways. To be strong and to just suck it in, that just doesn't really cut it. At this point, you have to be strong enough to be vulnerable and to communicate, I need help and I need to talk to somebody. And I think that that's been a big mantra that's helped me be able to address and be able to move forward and to still honor my dad's memory, but at the same time, be able to still be a fully functional and person that is trying to achieve actualization through education and through my professional career. But with our students, you know, I want to ask for them, how can they access mental health support services within the university? Are there any specific procedures or protocols that they should be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first step is filling out an intake, which can be done either in our office in South 280 or online through our website.
Mm-hmm.
After the intake is done, someone in the next 24 to 48 hours is going to contact you, one of the therapists who sees the intake, and they'll let you know what the next steps are, which is scheduling. Right now, we have two open positions, which we hope to fill soon. But what that means is we also have a wait list of about, right now, I think it's about 20 people. So that means about a month delay in services, unfortunately. But it is what it is, and we do the best we can with what we have. So those are the first steps in getting our services.
Wow. And, you know, hopefully you're able to fill those gaps. But
soon, man. Soon.
Soon.
Yes. We're interviewing.
Yeah,
yes, no. Soon. Another thing to that's related to this question is what to do if a student's in crisis.
Yeah.
So every once in a while we have a student that just comes in, maybe they're in tears or maybe they're having a panic attack or something like that. You know, we're not going to turn you away just because you know, hey, there's wait lists, 20 people. We can't see you until we see these others. Mm-hmm. No, if you're in crisis, like someone is still going to come and work with you and talk with you and all of that. Deal with the crisis as best we can. And then from there, okay, now let's put you on the wait list and eventually go get back in for services. So it's not, we're just going to close our doors to you because there's a wait list.
Wow. And you know, that's very meaningful because, you know, one of the things that I often think about is what about the students who are in crisis, but, you know, just can't say anything. And I always walk past that bench that's next to the bayou.
Yeah, it's the yellow bench.
Did y'all have an opportunity to collaborate on that or like, you know,
what
is the meaning of that bench?
So that's actually a suicide awareness bench.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a, I wish I could remember her name, a lady's son killed himself. This was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so she started a nonprofit. And so she collaborates with different institutions, higher education institutions included.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to us and we got this bench. And one of our therapists came up with the slogan that's on the bench. And we had kind of a ceremony when we had it installed. And it was a cool event.
Yeah, yeah. I got one of those yellow t-shirts from that event.
Yeah, with the semicolon on it, right?
Yeah, yeah. What is it? Some of my friends have the semicolon tattoo. What does that mean?
Without getting too deep, it takes a little bit different meaning for different people. Yep. But if you think about a sentence, a lot of sentences end in a period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you kill yourself or you die in some other way, that's the period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, semicolon means, well, we're going to keep going. So for some people, the semicolon is about creating awareness. For some people, it means that they actually came close themselves to ending their life. And that's a reminder for them that, hey, it wasn't a period. Life continues.
Wow. That one's very deep and meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think more often than not, we talk about stuff like that with our friends.
Mm-hmm. More often than not.
More often than not, you know.
Or more not than often, I think.
One of those.
That's one of the challenges is that people don't talk about it enough. You know, think about the way you described your own culture. Like, people suffer in silence. They think the strong thing is to not talk about whatever their emotional state is or whatever their suffering is.
Mm-hmm.
But we all suffer. I mean, that's a given. Like, we're going to suffer until we die.
Yeah.
That's the way life is. We have a choice in how we respond to the suffering. For some young people, the choice is taken away by them being told, just suck it up and don't talk to anyone about it. You know, so unfortunately, it's not talked about enough.
Well, I'd like to ask you, you know, as friends, you know, we want to reach out to one another and we want to be there for our friends. As students, how can we support our friends to be there for them during challenging times?
Paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you know that you have a friend that is very consistent, we use the gym as an example again, very consistent in the gym, and all of a sudden like your friend is just not going to the gym at all.
No.
Like they don't shave, they don't shower, like they're not working out. Like that can be a signal to you that there's something that's going on in his life. Now, of course, he has to be willing to talk about it with you, but you can open the door and say, hey man, I kind of noticed that some things are different. Like, anything you want to talk about? He might say no, but at least he knows at that point that there's someone out there that cares and is paying attention.
I think it all boils down to having someone who cares about you and they're willing to check in on you and they're willing to listen and be there for you. And I think that's really the first step to, you know, getting on the path to mental wellness. I think that's, well,
listening is hard.
Yeah.
You know, I see it all the time with friends where like you'll have a friend group and there's the friend that one-ups all the other friends. Like you tell a story that's a good story and they have something better, or you tell a story that's an awful story and they have something worse, and that doesn't help. You know, like that person is thinking about, well, what am I going to say next? While you're still talking, and so instead of listening what you're talking about, they're wrapped up in their own world. So it's hard to listen.
You know, I've always wondered, what is that phenomenon called?
I don't know.
No, I don't know.
Selfishness, I guess.
Oh my God. No. But you have to be able to get out of your way to be able to listen to others, and I think that solves like a lot of the problems. You know, to just be able to listen.
A tremendous amount. You know, think about our conversation today. I make a statement, and then you reflect it back to me with how you interpret it. Like, that's listening. You know, and so if you make a comment to me in therapy, like, I can reflect it back how I hear it, not parroting it back to you, but reflecting it back. And then you feel like, wow, like someone's actually listening to me. That's new. And then it gives you this sense of like, there is someone out there that's going to listen. And then in your personal life, the people that don't listen, you start to become a little bit more intolerant, because this therapeutic relationship is showing you that, wait, someone does care. And this is what caring looks like. These people, maybe they don't care like I thought they did. And that's not to say like a mother or a father or something doesn't love you. They just haven't learned to listen. Maybe they're more directive in their approach. You know, I don't want everyone to go home and be like, oh, mom, you hate me because you're not listening the way that therapist said to listen. That's not what I'm trying to say. But as you get to know people, you can figure out who listens, who doesn't.
And that one's really challenging.
So hard.
Because, you know, many of us are responsible. I have a friend, a close friend of mine, and it wasn't that until that she, like, sort of popped the bubble on me, like, that I'm being more intentional in listening whenever we have our conversations, and also asking follow-up, being engaged, you know, how is your day going? What have you done today? And, you know, that's not like that, but, you know, just to give you an idea of, like, you know, to be intentional in listening and, like, fully being present in the conversation.
Good learning experience for you.
It is a good learning experience. But, you know, I want to ask you, in terms of, you know, we've talked about listening. We talked about some of the services that you offer. But you mentioned you also help students out in some ways in terms of, like, helping them with time management. Tell me a little bit about the holistic approach that you take at UHD Counseling.
I suppose that depends on what you mean by holistic.
More well-rounded, you know.
Well, even then, and I don't want to press too much on the definition of holistic. There's counseling centers who employ, like, a psychiatrist, who employ someone that does assessments for things like autism, things like ADHD, and things like that. So in the true holistic sense, we don't offer holistic services. To answer your question, though, a little bit more specifically to UHD, like, we do collaborate frequently with other departments. You know, so we have, you know, like, the Accelerated Transfer Academy, we'll go and do outreach or presentations for them. We have professors that reach out to us and ask us to come speak to their classes. The Gator Success Institute, we do a lot of work with them. There's a natural collaboration between us and several other departments because of what we do and what those departments need. So there is a lot of collaboration in that sense.
Wow. And just connecting it back together with being able to create that visibility and showing that the services are available is really important. I want to ask you, when it comes to students that you've talked to over the years, you know, you mentioned that it's confidential.
100%.
What are some of the success stories generally, like, when you see a person come in at the beginning and whenever they transition out? Like, are they two different people?
That's the hope. You know, a very common, what's the way to say it? A very common behavior I see in our students is they compare themselves to others constantly. Like that person has this and I don't, or that person is this and I don't, or I have all of this and no one else does. My family is like this and theirs isn't. And that immediately, like, takes away, it becomes a thief of any joy that they could have in the present moment. And so one of the things I try to do in therapy with students is get them to start comparing themselves to themselves. And when we can look at myself yesterday, if I can be a tiny bit better in just whatever area than I was yesterday, then I can always keep the needle moving in the direction that I want it to go. And that self-to-self comparison is really powerful. I used to work out every single day, and now I'm not. There's a comparison to self to highlight that, hey, I need to find a new acceptable starting place to get my self-care back on track. Conversely, and maybe the more powerful comparison, is I used to be depressed all the time, and now I'm not, or I'm just depressed some of the time, or almost none of the time. I used to be anxious all the time, and now I'm not. I used to self-harm, I used to cut, and now I don't. Like, those are really powerful comparisons. And then you can ask the client, well, what do you think changed? And then as they identify what changed, it's, well, their behavior, their self-concept, how they approach life. And that for them is this powerful sort of eye-opener that, wait, like, I can do things differently. Like, I don't have to abuse myself the way that whatever my parents or whoever else abused me. I don't have to speak to myself in this awful way. I can be more compassionate. And then they learn about themselves. And they learn that there's this new way of being. It's powerful, man.
It is. And I felt the chill whenever you were saying those words, specifically, you know, going back to just being present. I think that a lot of us, more often than not, whenever we're going through our studies or we're going through the daily pressures of life, we get that anxiety, that inner voice. What advice would you have to someone to be able to break that cycle of the negative talk?
Well, the first step is being aware of it. You know, like, so often we make these comparisons, we treat ourselves with all this judgment, we don't even know that we're doing it. You know, a cool success story, there was a client that I worked with who, like, this person's self-talk was in the voice of a parent that treated them awfully their entire life. And as soon as the person realized that, like, oh wait, like, I'm doing the exact same things in my parents' voice that they did to me, it's like a light bulb went off and they're like, oh, well, I don't want to treat myself like that, I want to treat myself in a different way. And then we didn't need therapy after that. Awesome, they figured it out, you know. But to your point about advice, the first step is being aware of it. How can I just draw a little bit of attention to how I treat myself and how I speak to myself? No need to change anything, just draw some attention. And that naturally brings people to a place of, like, oh wow, like, I'm being awful. to myself, I want to change that. Okay, well, now the desire is there. In session, we can practice reframing negative self-statements. But most of the work in therapy is done outside of the counseling room. We can create a model. Oh, hey, you just said this. What's a more gentle way to say it? And they're like, oh, well, I can say it this way. Okay, cool. So this week, see what happens. Try that. You know, and that's a good first step and a good second step to doing the thing.
Something you said stood out to me, and it was the idea of facing your fear. I don't want to run away from it today. Let's face that fear. You know, change is one of the things that's hardwired into human nature that is resistance. We're resistant to change, but if someone wants to make a change, let's talk about that change. How do they make that change?
Well, the first step, like you were saying earlier, is that change is really hard and it's scary. You know, if you think about a cigarette smoker who doesn't want to quit smoking, like they know what's going to happen. Cancer, COPD, emphysema. Typically, there's always this exception story of, oh, he smoked until he was 100 and got hit by a car. Okay, well, most smokers, they know what's going to come. But there's a certain comfort that we have in knowing what the future holds.
Yeah.
Like if I'm a smoker and I know that how I'm going to die, well, that's kind of comforting because at least I can predict that. Mm-hmm. Change is the opposite of that. If I change, well, now I have to think about what this future is that I can't predict. Terrifying. And so then, you know, use the word resistance. I think maybe a more appropriate word is ambivalence. Like we're almost paralyzed. Like we're not happy continuing to do this and we're terrified of change. And so we get stuck.
Yeah.
And then we don't know what to do. And so sometimes in therapy and in by themselves, turning towards the fear is important. One way to address fear is getting really intelligent about your fear. Think of like a phobia. Let's say you're terrified of cockroaches. Well, if you and you go and you learn as much as you possibly can about cockroaches, you're going to face the fear because you're learning all this. And so when you see a cockroach, naturally, all these lessons are going to come to mind. And you're like, I don't actually have to be afraid of that thing. There's other fears that are a little bit harder to get intelligent about. The fear of change, like you said, the fear of future, the fear of rejection. You know, I think the fear that we all really have is the fear that we're not worthy, that we're not good enough, that the people that we want love from are going to see us for who we really are and reject us and not love us. Like, that's the fear. And how do you get intelligent about that? I don't know. Like, like you can accept that it's there. And that's the key in sitting with it. You know, instead of thinking about bravery as a personality trait, thinking about bravery as a skill. Like if you go to the gym to build a muscle, what can I do to build bravery like a muscle?
Right.
And that's sitting with the fear. And you can sit with it through, like I said earlier, trying to get intelligent about it. You can sit with it through journaling. You can sit with it by talking to a therapist about it. I mean, one of the coolest experiences I've had in counseling is being able to see someone like in session in front of me come face to face with this deep fear. And it's an incredibly painful experience. But after they get past it and they have this sort of relief isn't the right word, but it's the word that I'm using right now. They have this relief.
That sort of catharsis.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. That they're like, oh, like that's the thing. And I came face to face with it and I cried and I panicked and I'm still alive.
Wow.
And it's really cool to see clients have that sort of light bulb moment. Like you said, the cathartic experience of being able to do it and come out. So yes, getting intelligent about the fear, journaling about the fear, talking about the fear, increasing bravery as a skill. And there's other methods, more behavioral methods. The best way, the absolute best way to conquer a fear, it's called flooding. Now what flooding is, let's say you're terrified of women. Flooding would be every single woman that you speak to, every single one. You see her, you go talk to her. Doesn't matter, go talk to her, that's flooding. Now that's terrifying. Clients don't like that. If they're scared of heights, okay, every tall building you see, take the elevator to the top floor, do it. No one wants to do that. It's terrifying, it's too much. But that is the best way to get over that type of fear. A more systematic way is something called systematic desensitization. Mm-hmm. So let's say your fear is driving. You got in some awful car accident. You know, you're trying to process the accident, deal with the trauma that came for it. You're just, I just will not drive.
Yeah.
You know, that's the fear. You even get close to a car, you're like, ah, panic attack. So in a systematic way, it would be something like, well, I'm just going to go stand next to my car for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes until it becomes unbearable. I'm gonna go inside.
Yeah.
And maybe that's too much. And so you have to enter into this gentle negotiation with yourself. Where you know what? It was too much trying to stand next to the car. So instead, I'm just gonna stand inside. I'm just gonna hold the keys. Okay, well, maybe I can do that for 10 minutes before it becomes overwhelming. So you do that until it's not overwhelming anymore. And then you stand next to the car. Do that until it's not overwhelming anymore. Then maybe you just sit in the back seat. And then maybe the passenger seat. And then eventually you get to the front seat. Then eventually you can start the car. And you have this systematic way where you find an acceptable starting place. Mm-hmm. through gentle negotiation with yourself, and then slowly build back up to where you were.
I think I like the systematic approach.
Yes. And we talked about comparisons earlier, and this is critical. What happens is that people compare themselves, like, oh, the old version of me used to be able to drive 100 on the freeway with no problem, right? And this new me can't even get in the car. So that clearly means I'm broken and I'm beyond any sort of saving or fixing or anything, right? And so then they have to be gentle with themselves. They have to show themselves compassion. Hey, I used to be able to go 100 on the freeway without an issue. Don't drive 100 though, y'all. Stick to the speed limit. I'm not advocating for speeding. But I used to be able to do this thing and I can't do it quite the same way. Yeah. But there's a reason. You're in this awful car accident and there's something traumatic that came out of it. And so showing compassion to yourself is the way to kind of get through it. You know, students all the time, they judge themselves, we talked about it earlier, so harshly. And that sort of behavior actually, unless you're David Goggins, like that sort of behavior gets in the way of you achieving your goal.
Wow.
Because you're judging yourself so harshly. You think you're a failure every time you don't do something well. And we need to fail. But we need to fail and then encourage ourselves and be compassionate with ourselves. That increases the likelihood that you're going to achieve whatever it is you're going to achieve.
I think back to three things, actually. So first off, the idea of just failing. I think to that first scene in the Christopher Nolan version of Batman, the first one where Bruce Wayne falls down the well and he's in the Bat Cave and essentially Alfred picks him up and he's like, why did we fall, Master Wayne? Because we pick ourselves back up again, or something along those lines. So that's the first one. The second one is going back to this author. She's based here in Houston. Her name is Brené Brown. She has this book called Dare to Lead. And one of the things that she does in the professional setting is be able to rumble professionally and be able to have those conversations that are difficult to face your fears. So, you know, we have to be able to rumble with ourselves to be able to rumble with others and be able to be brave enough to be honest and to have those conversations. And the last thing, and, you know, talk about being those fears of the cockroaches and all those things. It's sort of like our own internal version of the fear factor. And, you know, going back to what you're saying about flooding, you know, maybe that's what they were doing at the time in reality television. You know, a box full of tarantulas and your head is in it. Like, that's ultimate flooding. But, you know, we once we get past our fear, the possibilities are limitless. And, you know, it's about being compassionate with ourselves through those difficult moments. The car accident, I went through a rollover. And I mean, the same day I had to
get... Oh, you were actually in a car accident?
I was actually
in a car accident. Oh, wow. Okay.
But the same day I had to get behind the wheel and I had to get where I needed to go. But, you know, the systematic approach, you know, it took me time to be able to get back to 100.
Right.
I want to just keep going because this is just such an interesting conversation. I really would love to learn more. But if there's one takeaway that you want to give students in terms of being able to seek help and access our services, what would you say to them?
Don't wait until you're about to graduate. Well, because our services end when you graduate. But even then, you know, if you can get in a session or two before graduation, it'll be helpful. Like, but I think a better takeaway is, even if you don't think you need help, come talk anyway. You know, sometimes, like, I call it maintenance therapy. Like, sometimes people treat therapy like the dentist. Like, I'm going to go twice a year just to do a checkup on my life. And sometimes we have blind spots. Like, we're not aware of something that's taking place. And being able to speak your life out to someone. And a good therapist will take you through different areas of life, you know, if you don't come in with a presenting concern. Being able to do that can sometimes shed some light on what potentially is there that you're avoiding. You know, avoidance behavior is, I know we're getting a little away from your question, but avoidance behavior is another thing that I see very often. You know, even things like the gym or yoga, like that can be avoidance. You know, if there's this huge thing in your life that you don't want to address, you're like, okay, I'm just going to engage in self-care for 8 hours a day. Well, no, you're here. That's a really beautiful place to hide, but you're avoiding something. And so being able to talk to someone, a therapist, even if you don't think that there's anything wrong, can be incredibly helpful.
The mind is a very powerful thing.
So powerful.
It can reframe and it can give you perspectives. And the idea of like spending 8 hours in the gym is good, but then that's also a form of avoidance if you're trying to not do something. So
right, unless you're trying to be a bodybuilder, or like a top-notch breakdancer or something like that, because then that time in the gym serves a purpose, right? But if like, well, you know, my relationship with my mom is awful, so I'm just gonna go work out 8 hours a day. Okay, well, what can we do to fix that relationship? You know, that's another thing for students, always about somewhere around session four, Like, they're going to tell me about a bad relationship in their life. Yeah. I shouldn't say bad. That sounds judgmental. A less than optimal relationship in their life that they want to work on. Like, yeah. Relationships are hard.
This has been a very powerful conversation, and I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to just talk with us. And I hope that this conversation serves a purpose for a student who might need help or might need to be able to learn more about these services. But Timothy Coulter, thank you so much for coming out to the program
today. Yeah, thank you so much. And let me know when round two is. You know, we can get back into it.
I love it. Well, this has been Gator Bites, the official business podcast of the Maryland Davies College of Business. I've been your host, Miguel Gomez. And I want to remind you to always take a bite out of business, and we'll see you later, Gators.